This episode is available to watch as a video podcast exclusively on the Talking Backwards Patreon page. Sign up today over at patreon.com/talkingbackwards.
Welcome back to Talking Backwards. Will you shut your mouth? It's a hot start. Welcome back to Talking Backwards, a Twin Peaks podcast. I am Dave Jackson, joined by Patrick Mahan.
Hey, everybody.
And Tyler Mullins.
Dr. Little Poops.
Our resident Dr. Little Poops.
Tonight.
We're here today. We are here today to discuss The Final Dossier, a book by Mark Frost, written at the conclusion of The Return. This apparently is here to give us answers. Will we get answers? We'll see. It's a big task, so we've got a full panel today. We're also joined by Jeremiah Beaver, a.k.a. Take the Ring. How are we doing, Mr. Ring?
What's up?
And from the 25YL site, we have with us once again Mr. John Bernardi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for being here. We're going to go down every rabbit hole and up every apple tree on this one. Mm-hmm. Going to have a big time. I guess Tammy has self-appointed herself as the archivist.
Got a problem with that. I got beef.
Yep.
I got beef.
Right out of the gate.
Yep.
Right out of the gate. It did not seem at first like this was actually an assignment. It seemed more like she just kind of took it upon herself to do this and follow up. I think by the end we find out that she was in fact enlisted to follow up on some things. Man, I think the only thing I really took away from the introduction is a cool line about the perception of change from day to day versus from a distance, and how, you know, when you're living in the moment, as things change around you, you don't really see it. But if you are coming from a third party perspective and you see things differently years down the road than they were compared to before, that's a huge contrast. And this kind of phenomenon is called A Kind of Mercy by Tammy in the opening. And I thought that was very, very cool. But there's a lot here. So I guess maybe just a general overarching, just general feelings kind of segment is called for. Patrick, how do you feel about The Final Dossier going in?
Going in, I mean, I was pretty excited about it because, I mean, I hadn't stopped thinking and still haven't stopped thinking about The Return. So I was just excited to just read a little bit more. I hadn't read The Secret History prior to The Return. I think I just wasn't aware of it. I read Secret History after The Return, and then this came out. So it was just great timing. And I'm going to save a lot of what I feel about it for the final thoughts, but I just want to say I couldn't have been more excited kicking it off with Leo Johnson. I was like, well, I've been wondering what that old chap was up to.
Yeah, Tyler, how did you feel about this going into it?
It's a
cold.
A novel, as it says on the cover.
Yes.
It's not a novel at all.
It's 130 some odd pages, like not that deep a tome.
Yeah, it's not even longer than Tammy's neck.
Oh.
It's a book.
Tyler, so fun fact though, Tyler didn't read the book. He listened to the audiobook on the flight home from Twin Peaks.
Yes.
Yeah, just knocked it out. Instance. Yeah.
I like the way it's broken up.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. It's
18 sections, 18 episodes. I thought that was really cool. Just a nice little numerical... There we go.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Pragmatic as always, Tyler.
Right in there.
Mr. Ring, how do we feel about The Final Dossier?
Good. When it came out, I was like, I knew it. I I got it like the day that it came out, and it was nice and short, and I think that I read it all in one night. And yeah, in a weird way, it felt like, since I did it in one night, it felt like kind of like one more episode. But again, it's broken up in 18 parts. It also tied, certainly the opening made a lot more sense when it comes to memory and how we perceive the world. And again, all kind of seeds planted in the secret history that also definitely played out in the return, like big time. I have mixed feelings about this book, but I enjoy it. I think it's cool. I reference it all the time. I like the layout. I like that it's a dossier. I like the black and white images that are used in it. I think it's presented cool. If nothing else, this is like Mark Frost, kind of like the last episode in the open-endedness and the darkness of the return. I still think they wrote it together, and that's the show that they both wanted to make. However, like, I think since Lynch, like, visually had kind of like more to do with the return, this is kind of Frost, like, oh, hey, by the way, I got some more stuff to say about all this stuff mm-hmm. that we just laid out for you guys. And I don't think Frost said in an interview, and we'll get into this later with specifics, but there's a lot of like theories about the return that people have. A lot of that stuff comes from the final dossier, simply because that was the last thing that was put out, and it's kind of like Frost's take on stuff. But again, this is, and Frost said this in an interview too, that it's Tammy's perspective of, it's Tamara Preston's perspective of what happened. So, which, I mean, that gets into the subjective nature of the return itself too, right? Like, we're all going to watch it, and we are all going to take away our own thing and kind of have our own theory and our own perspective of what that was and what memory is and memory and timelines and how it related to the original show and all that. And then this book is Tammy's subjective view of all of those events, basically. So that's cool. I like it.
Very cool. Mr. Bernardi, how do we feel about the final dossier?
Yeah, I'm kind of in that same boat where, like, I wasn't really quite sure what to make of it at the beginning, but, like, it turned out to be a really solid explanation of, like, Frost philosophy. And I think the subjectivity really comes through because, yeah, I mean, you don't start the book out with the Albert's autopsy of Leo Johnson if you don't want to set the tone. And it really sets the tone in that, mm-hmm. you know, like the birthday cake and the hair and everything, you know, it's like, we know that Wyndham Earle didn't throw him that party. We know that it was, you know, Bobby and Shelley doing that stuff. So basically we know more than Albert in that one. And then Tammy is reacting, or Tamara is I differentiate because they seem like different characters in a lot of ways.
It's true.
Tamara understands like even less of the context there. So like, you know, you're getting her reacting to Albert's information as if it's absolute truth. And, you know, it's like basically we're being presented with, this is an unreliable narrator right at the beginning, which really helped me a lot when we got into the Palmer area. Yeah, it's a complicated book. And I kind of think of it like the autobiography of Dale Cooper, because that was from one single agent's point of view. And there's a lot of stuff in that book that was like really like, you know, it's like, did you really want to do that with this character or this storyline? And like, there's just a lot of things that are complicated about this book. But overall, I would say the Jacoby and the Log Lady stuff alone really make this a must read.
Absolutely.
Terrifying. Yeah. TP.
Yeah. And like you said, we open, I think, pretty strong with Albert's autopsy.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe it. Like, Leo Johnson. I think that was also, I wasn't ex- expecting going into this, getting updates on characters that weren't in the return. I just thought maybe that would be completely glossed over. So I just had the biggest smile immediately because I was like, Leo?
Oh, yeah.
What?
It's just...
Yeah, it's crazy how this book just picks up on every right. every little plot thread that you can come across in episode 29 yes. is in this book. It's crazy how it's like a direct continuation in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. It's all connected.
For one, the just outright disdain that Albert has for Leo, like he does not hide that at all in an official report. But I also found it interesting that he was not venomed to death by spiders, which were not venomous, but actually shot 5 times, and that's how he ultimately met his end, by an FBI marksman that we have to assume was Earl.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like some of that might have been, I almost got the impression that maybe Mr. C went there yeah. to get stuff. I wasn't thinking that right away, but I got the impression just reading more, I was like, did he go there and get like the FBI briefcase, you know, like that we see in the return yeah. that we saw Wendell Merle with? I was like, did he just go and just shoot Leo because he was there?
My first reading was that it was that Earl did this elaborate trap, and then with the spiders and all this stuff, and then he was walking out the door and he just turned around and said, ah, screw it, and like just shot him.
I could see that so, too.
That was my first read on it. But then after like watching the return again, and like you get online and mess around and like, oh, maybe he left him there. And yeah, maybe it was Mr. C came back, shot him, got the briefcase and some of the other Earl stuff that Mr. C seems to have going on. Maybe he went back to the cabin and gathered up anything that he might need. So again, yeah, that's why this is cool, because it's still, that's why the Frost stuff, even the Secret History, like people kind of bag on him sometimes for like maybe giving too concrete of answers or kind of like, you know, trying to box in the world a little bit. But the way he writes, it's not that way. Like it still interweaves in and out of the show. And, you know, so even like the autopsy thing, you can go a million different ways in this, mm-hmm. like, and just like John said, with like, we know with the birthday cake, we know the story, like it's pretty amazing. As much as I will get into how many problems I have with the book, it is pretty amazing that just this 2-page or 4-page autopsy report is like, your mind's already going like, what is this? What is, oh, I know what that is. Well, that's Bill, or that's Shelley and, you know, Shelley and Bobby had to do with da 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 da. But then, like, well, what about Wendell Merle? And like, oh yeah, the transports. And like, they're not poisonous. And I don't know. I just loved it. I love this. You're right. It was a strong opening. I loved it.
That is a really cool idea. That I, much like Tammy, I just took this report as fact and said, like, it's probably Wendell Merle. I was like, yeah, it probably is Wendell Merle. But now knowing what happens between Wendell Merle and Bob in the lodge, when he basically absorbs him and then Evil Coop leaves, he would now have Windermere's knowledge of what was going on, what that setup was, headed there. It's like, oh, you probably have FBI stuff I could use. Gets there, sees the tarantula trap, is like, oh yeah, that's fun. Goes ahead and executes this guy and then takes what he needs. That's a way cooler scene to me than just accepting that Windermere came back. It's like, nah.
He grabbed an extra bonsai tree to put near the glass box.
Yeah.
Just for good measure, you know.
It's so funny. Like, sorry to jump in one last time. It is funny that I don't think Wendell Merle is mentioned by name once in the return. Not once. But the bonsai tree and there's the briefcase, the bonsai tree, little stuff like it. He's definitely in there. I mean,
yeah.
You don't find out what happened to Annie Blackburn, but at least her name is mentioned. You remember Hawk tells
us. Well, Hawks, yeah.
You know, Hawk is explaining the diary pages. So like people's names come up even if they're not explained, but Earl's name doesn't come up at all. But there's all kinds of little things with Mr. C that are very, like Wendell Merle is in the return, even though he's not even mentioned or seen, basically.
I like that too. And that makes sense even with Leo, because it's like, Annie, I get with the connection to the diary pages, totally. Her name should be brought up there. Like Leo, it's like, regardless of him being alive or not, like just the fact that he's not mentioned at all, like just irrelevant, you know? It's like, he's just not, why would you mention him? Because he's been dead for, you know, I mean, we don't know that. We can speculate, but we don't know that. So why would anyone just suddenly be like, hey, how's Leo? Or what, you know, weren't you married to Leo? Or, you know, whatever it could have been. Whereas like the little Wyndham like hints here and there are really cool, especially on rewatches.
Yeah, Leo's just really out of the zeitgeist in The Return. Like nobody's talking about it.
I was.
It would be like that real life.
You were asking questions about it.
That's what I like, is just because like you wouldn't just be talking about him for, you know, for no reason. Like there's just, there was no reason for his name to come up.
Whereas Wyndham Earl, Albert is explaining the Blue Rose Task Force to Tammy, and he says Chet Desmond, he says Cooper, he says David Bowie or Jeffries. He names everybody, but doesn't name Earl. So even, I don't know, that almost feels like intentional in a way. I don't know. Anyway, just there was an opportunity to say his name and they chose not to.
He was blacklisted for what he
did. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. They probably scrubbed him.
They stripped his,
Interestingly, Wyndham Earl is mentioned in the new U.S. government UFO report, though, by the way. That's a joke.
Okay.
The UFO report.
I don't keep up with these things, so.
Okay.
It came out
yesterday.
Yeah.
I thought you guys would be, or Friday. I thought you guys would be with me.
No, I read it and you were making me
think.
I was like, what?
He was real.
We accept anything that's said as truth. We are rubes. Keep this in mind going forward. That was an excellent joke and it did land. Good job.
Everybody laugh. Okay. I'll just laugh.
Well, we got some closure on this knuckle dragger, and that's more than we expected to get.
Yep. I think it's some openness shit thing. Retconning.
Let's hear it.
That's it. Oh. Why couldn't he have just escaped and gone on to
truck
business school or something?
Gone on to truck around.
He
was reincarnated.
He started Enron.
In the Elks Point 9, that was Leo reincarnated.
There you go. Yeah.
Truck you guy.
I like that in Albert's report, he's reporting to Cole and he makes a passing reference to Cole's imported nieces, really fun to me. After the niece he was entertaining at the hotel, who takes forever to leave.
Loved that as well.
And I agree that Twin Peaks probably should have a craft brewery, if anywhere should.
I do have a question on the autopsy report.
Okay.
The 5 gunshot wounds.
Yes.
And then the 6th bullet lodged internally.
The 6th bullet was when he got shot previously.
By Shelley.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, in the series.
I didn't know he got shot in the back.
Yeah, you just hear the gunshot, and then he runs off into the night like an animal.
Screaming like an idiot.
screaming like an idiot.
You know, how idiots scream.
Yes.
Yeah, just like that. Well, speaking of Shelley.
Yep. Good seg.
This promising high school student with a tragic tale. So I actually was a little uncomfortable reading this bit because from the way it's posited here, like, didn't we get a different origin story for Shelley meeting Leo in Secret History?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, no.
Go ahead, John.
No, I don't even remember Leo being like overly mentioned in that book.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think he was either.
I thought it was mentioned in passing that there was just like Shelley was on duty at the RRR and he came in and was kind of nice to her one time and that was what sparked their whole relationship. Maybe I invented that.
Oh, maybe. No, hey, maybe. The big thing is the show Shelley kind of recaps her interaction, how she says stuff like, oh, you know, that, you know, I met him in school and he was so great and now he's a jerk. And
this is the unofficial version.
Right.
But what made me uncomfortable is it says that she meets Leo the night of her junior prom when she goes to the Bang Bang Bar, who serves her, even though she's underage, meets Leo there. He liquors her up further. And that night, things consummate, apparently. Would she not have been like 17 in this interaction?
Yeah.
Hate that.
Yeah.
Don't enjoy that.
Yeah, but Leo's not a good guy, though, Dave.
Yeah.
What?
What?
That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay, that tracks now. Yeah.
And we remember who owns the Roadhouse, the Renault family.
Yeah.
This is
not.
Yeah, who are not, we're not strangers to that sort of activity.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hard truths.
Hard truths. There's a few of those in this. It said also that it's only a year after Leo dies that Shelley and Bobby get married. Or, you know, run off and do a Reno, Nevada wedding. Where family does not attend. And they are supported by Norma and Betty Briggs when they find out that either she is about to have or has had a little baby Becky, who I'm surprised we didn't follow up with, really. She's, this is her only mention in this book.
No, no, I got it flagged because I got beef with some twin, I got beef with some Twin Peaks community, and yeah, I got the page marked. We'll get to that a little later.
All right.
Don't forget.
Don't forget. Yeah, no, I'm not going to.
Like, this has happened. To bring back up Shelley and Bobby.
I'm not going
to say, like, Dave having beef at the beginning of an episode saying, oh, we'll circle back to that. We never do.
I still don't know what it was.
I know.
I'm sure I'm beefing. I don't know about what.
You are. You were.
You probably never returned to it because of the changed timeline.
Whoa. Yeah, I forgot it even happened. Just forgot it even happened. Yep.
So I want to propose something here, and maybe John can back me up or not, but like, because this opens with the Leo Johnson autopsy, and then it goes into Shelley Johnson, and like the last line of the Shelley Johnson thing is only like, you know, a page and a half or 2 pages. Right. If it ends with, of all the personal stories I've now surveyed in Twin Peaks, Shelley seems to be one of the luckiest ones. And then that's kind of it. And then, like I said, like a little later they touch on Becky, and I can't remember if there's a Bobby section or not, but then of course Major Briggs comes up at the end. So basically the Briggs, Shelley Johnson and the Briggs clan kind of make little appearance, like they're kind of like in my mind, kind of like a through line to this book specifically. Basically, Mark Frost is like, hey man, like the log lady dies, no one knows what happened in the return, like, you know, you're about to read Annie and Audrey and you know, everybody's got a sad ending in Twin Peaks, but right up front, just like, hey, Shelley makes it out all right. And then again, a lot of this book has
her daughter threw her off her car.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I guess she didn't stay with Red because he was bad news.
Yeah, right. So
no mention of Red.
Yeah, yeah. So and then that gets into the other timeline thing. Did that stuff really happen? Did after the doppelgangers was destroyed, did the kind of weirdness of Twin Peaks like back off a little bit? Did Red go away?
John says no.
John says no.
It will never go away.
Well, yeah.
It's been there since before Lewis and Clark, and it's going to be there like centuries from now.
The return is the evil in the woods is definitely worse in the return than in, say, the original show. Like, it feels like it's seeped into the town, the puking kid, the, you know, from like daily gun violence stuff to that like zombie weird kid to like all the people in the roadhouse and just everybody the rash. Yeah, everyone seems to be kind of like losing their minds. I just think that Red is kind of a part of that. Like he's a physical manifestation of the, I mean, well, whatever. Because you can get into the, like, this could all be just a societal statement about how the world's a darker place or whatever. But I don't know. I think that I thought that that was cool at the beginning. It's like, hey, Shelley and the Briggs are kind of like the good. They represent the good side of Twin Peaks, at least in this book. Mm-hmm. What, you know, as we go forward in this short book.
I'll agree. And it does say that she's one of the lucky ones, even though it does mercifully omit the fact that her daughter stole her car at gunpoint and
attempted
to murder her husband. Fine that's not there, I guess. It could be that because of what we know by the end of the book, that things are kind of rewriting themselves. But a lot of things also have the same outcomes. Like Leland still dies in a different way, but he's still taken out of the picture.
Yes.
Like it doesn't change everything. Like certain key players still have their decided ends. Like everyone kind of has a destiny here. Right. But I do like the theory that Red is only there if there's opportunity for him to be there, in the sense that there's something that can manifest. Like he could be just like the grandson.
Yes.
He can be, because he is a magician, he can be that type to just opportunistically show up to invade this good family and kind of poison that.
Yes.
So that's fun.
Word.
I feel like we spend a little too much time on several of these chapters, but specifically the Horns and the Haywards. Like there's not much here that I think we didn't know. But we get a lot of information about stuff I didn't need to know. Like that doesn't really impact. Yeah, and I mean she's conspicuously not a poet at the end of her cycle. Like she goes into
I got beef. We know. I mean, come on. We know she's a poet. Come on. She's the reason there's so many poems in the Twin Peaks universe.
She's a poet and you know it.
Exactly.
But, yeah, I like that it was they took time to single out Harriet and say she went into pediatrics, did not write, is not a poet, is not known for that.
But she made it through the whole weird, traumatic family histories.
Right, mm-hmm. One of the lucky ones.
And
yeah, but like there's this big underlying thing, like even with Carl Rod, like where basically if you can survive the darkness, if you can like push your way through it, the first thing you do is after being able to heal yourself is you help others. So it really fits in with that theme.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That is a really good observation too.
I guess this is where we talk about Doc Hayward. I mean, for me it felt, just from what we've seen of Doc Hayward in the series, it seemed like out of character to me for him to just up and leave. Like, I don't know. I guess the events of that finale were just haunted him. So devastating. He just didn't seem like the type of man to do that.
Once you physically assault a family friend and the mar that could leave on your reputation, you probably pack up and take your practice elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And your daughter figures out that you've been hiding this big, gigantic bomb of a secret. Mm-hmm. And I love how this book doesn't say anything about what the actual secret was. Mm-hmm. Like, even like the show never said it officially. Like, nobody ever said it officially that Ben was Donna's dad.
It's just heavily, heavily implied. This even leads to his divorce from Eileen.
Mm-hmm.
Like whatever they argued about that night, whatever fight or attack happened, whatever the actual events were, everything around that dissolved his friendship with Ben, his marriage, and caused him to basically seclude himself.
That was the other thing too. You never knew Eileen's, and please correct me if I'm wrong, like why she was in a wheelchair. It's just casually dropped and done in a sentence, like, oh, she was in a car accident. Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. I got that
confirmed.
Threw her off the car.
Perhaps.
In a different timeline.
Probably they're just
timeline.
There would have to be this really huge weight of guilt or this level of unforgivingness on one or both's part to, after for 26 years of marriage for there to be something that just, like, why now in your sunset years is it not worth it anymore?
Right.
And Eileen passes away not that much long after that.
She got the ability to walk back. And she's like, I'm walking out on you.
There it is.
I don't know.
Just for those miracle moments.
And then she walked in the street and went through that damn intersection.
Come on, Eileen.
Come on, Eileen. She couldn't walk until she had to walk away. This is how she led a nation.
Oh, no.
This does have a convergence. So this attack that, or we can say attack, we can say accident, whatever happened at the Hayward house when Ben was over there, landed Ben in the hospital with Audrey. Like, they're there at the same time.
Yeah.
So that kind of creates that, we're talking about through lines, that kind of brings that in here. So Ben Horn was there, even though I don't think he ever saw Cooper there or anything that might have happened.
Probably
that's not said. But yeah, it is pretty telling that Eileen, after separating from Doc that night, started getting a $7,500 a month stipend from a Horn LLC. Ben Horn's probably down his dad.
Yeah.
She probably says, Doc, I'm getting money. I can walk away from you.
Yep. Donna Horn.
I don't love it, but it does make sense. Let's go back to Donna.
Damn it.
Yeah, like, yeah, this is one of those things I didn't need to know this much about Donna at all. She wasn't in the return at all. I had closure, I think, with Donna. Yeah.
I think the only thing that I mentioned too just was that there was that one photo of her and Laura in the living room, the Palmer living room, and it was Laura Finn Boyle. Just interesting.
Yeah.
Is there a third timeline?
Oh, there are a thousand timelines.
Yeah, yeah.
In which Donna 2.0 hangs out with Laura and Laura still dies. Is that why there's no mention of why this is a totally different fucking person?
Yes.
I did, by the end of the return, I was pretty sure that there was a third timeline that we hadn't really gotten a lot of exposure to, but just bits and pieces. Like, we knew for sure that there were two different things going on, but by the end of it, it was like, there's got to be a third series of events happening that we are not privy to.
100%.
Yeah, we get deep into Donna's subsequent activities. Went on to study at Hunter College, signed with the Ford Modeling Agency, was very successful as a model, and afterwards cut off all contact with her Twin Peaks relationships, except for Audrey, who she wrote to twice.
Which is interesting.
Wrote to. Like, she's still passing notes.
Hey, sister.
Still passing notes, yeah. Donna. They were in a handful of scenes together, and I don't know. I thought that was interesting. Other than them being connected through being sisters now.
In a weird way, like, it does explain why she wasn't in the return. Basically, after the end of season two, it destroyed her family, and she split. But I got to say, like, this is one of the most, like, this struck me as, like, the most real of, I don't know, like, I've felt like, I've known people like this, like, there's an event and then, you know, they stop talking to their parents, you know, and, like, so the mom died and she doesn't go to the funeral because she's mad. But then, like, years later, you know, she does kind of reconcile with the father and, you know, she went to college and she did this and she did that. Like, I don't know, like, I didn't need this, don't care really. But, like, reading it, I was just like, man, yeah, that's totally how life is, like, what people have traumas and they don't get over and they hold grudges, and then there's, you know, people leave their hometown and, like, never look back and never talk to anybody, you know, and then maybe 30 years later maybe they'll patch things up with somebody. I don't know, that was just my kind of hot take on it. And so when I think about this book, I often think about Donna Hayward. And it is the Lara Flynn Boyle Donna Hayward. I don't know why that is necessarily.
I agree.
It certainly feels like.
Yeah. Because I was reading it. I'm trying to think of picture both of them, and I'm always Lara Flynn Boyle in this book.
Yeah, well, among other things, like that whole like Jack Nicholson, Lara Flynn Boyle thing is like heavily implied, I would say.
Yes. Yeah. Totally. Absolutely. And then my final thing is, this is page 28, the last page of the Donna Hayward thing is where it proves that in, at least in this timeline or this book or Frost timeline, Becky Johnson lives. The last page, right. The last line, the timely intervention of her mother, Shelley, and father, Deputy Bobby Briggs, appears to have spared Becky any lasting legal trouble, but Gersten has since believed to have left the area. So basically, like, Steven is on the run because he's a drug dealer, so Gersten's gone. But this is that one little line that basically, in Frost's world, Shelley survives, and so does her daughter, Becky. That's where they're the lucky ones. Mm-hmm. Now, where it gets interesting is, in my mind, like, it's hard to see, but in the subtitles of Steven and Gersten at the end of the return, like, it is heavily implied, like, I killed her or I shot her, or like, it is heavily implied.
Something, yeah.
He said, like, basically, it's implied that in the show, Becky is dead, that Steven shot Becky. And again, the camera, Mark Frost, Cyril Pons points at the trailer, and there's dark music, and there's just the trailer and whatever. And he's, you know, blowing snot everywhere and saying, like, I did it. Like, I shot her, like, I killed her, so whatever exactly he says. But it's like, context suggests that Becky is killed in the show, but Becky is alive in the book. And this is according to this line that, like, she got out of it. So my little theory on all of this is like, it was either the Reddit AMA or some other interview. Somebody said that to Mark Frost, oh, Becky's dead, right? Or like, did you write that? Is that supposed to mean that Steven killed her or whatever? And Frost does what Frost does. And he's kind of coy, like a little cheeky. Mm-hmm. Like, he's like, oh no, she's alive. Becky's alive. And the guy's like, well, yeah, but she's dead in the show. Like he said, I shot her. And Mark Frost is like, no, she's alive. And it's because she's alive in his book. She's alive in his story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to get too weird here, but like the whole Laura Palmer, like, I'm dead yet I live. And then there's the whole Schrodinger's cat thing, like the multiple worlds or whatever.
I love that.
And there's the whole like Shelley Johnson or Becky Johnson, whatever her name, what's her name, the actress name?
Amanda Seyfried?
Yeah, Seyfried, yeah. And like, before the return, she was going to be the new Laura Palmer. Like, people thought that the show, like, she would be the young girl in trouble or whatever. Like, Twin Peaks was going to come back as kind of this, you know, relaunching a new murder mystery, and that she was going to be the new Laura Palmer. And in a weird way, she kind of is, because she's dead. She dies in the show, but she lives in the book. Kind of like Laura Palmer is dead, but she's still alive, depending on what timeline you're in.
Or chapter of the bad boy drug dealer boyfriend slash husband. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway,
who's two timing on her?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But Becky's alive in the book, but dead in the show. And there you go. That's your David Lynch and Mark Frost split. That's your timeline split, that's your perception split, like however you want to read that.
So, can I give you a loophole?
Well, go for it.
Okay, so in this book, Steven is marked missing. Richard Horn is marked missing. You know, it's like both those guys are basically, we either see them die or we're like on the other side of a tree when a gunshot goes off.
Right.
And, you know, there's no mention of them dying in this one. So I've kind of felt like they both made a decision. Like Becky, when she was talking to her mom on the phone, you know, she chooses to go and have the pie and the coffee. Yep. And Steven decides to go further into this crap that he's in. And I think what ended up basically happening is there's a positive frequency and a negative frequency of this whole dream thing that is really, really logical. And I think they just like split off and like they don't, you know, Becky didn't know where Steven was. He went missing. And you know, like I think she basically fell into a positive, or you know, the positive frequency, and Steven, where he died, he's on the negative frequency. Yeah. And like it all exists, you know, the world is still there, but you know, it's like, you know, you just tune the radio dial a little bit this way and you see the one guy, and then you turn it the other way, and then you get, you know, classic rock, and you turn it a little bit further, mm-hmm. and you get Becky.
Yeah.
She I likes, love all that.
She likes like, Nickelback.
Oh God!
No, probably does. No, I really love all that because I haven't thought about especially how they are missing in the book, and we clearly see them, or at least with Richard, we see him die. But at least compared to the Laura Palmer with being missing and dead, I that's all awesome. And yeah, and of course, like Becky choosing the pie and coffee, like choosing the good. Going that route, that's all very interesting. So I like all of that a whole lot,
which makes me wonder, because I interpreted it as when I read that about them intervening and like basically saving Becky's life, I thought we saw that. Like, well, I didn't think she died in the series, because I saw that happen and I thought that got her away from it, and then Steve off by himself or cavorting with Gerson goes off the deep end, does his thing. But that's got me thinking now, am I seeing two different realities in the same show again? Mm-hmm. Like we see Steven at the tree dying after killing Becky.
Right.
And then when we see Becky in the diner, that's a different timeline that is detached from Steven's breakdown.
Right. I should. I brought that up in our part 15 because even when she goes around the tree, her shirt's buttoned up and it wasn't on the other side. So I was like, are we seeing another timeline? I think I brought that up in our part 15.
Yeah, I think you did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I chalked it up to continuity error, but.
Oh, yeah. You both. Yeah, totally. Yeah. But I, that's why I'm like, inconsistencies, no. Unofficial timelines, unofficial versions, as Jeffrey puts it, yes. That's how I refer to anything like that. Mm-hmm. I love it.
I do love the implication here in the book of Gersten's life being one of kind of praise and of opportunity and sheltering, it seems like, because it pretty much says that she's raised as a virtuoso and then real life is too much for her to handle. So yeah. She has this nervous breakdown that drives her to drugs and drives her to Steven and like drives her down that path. Like I love the implication of, you know, the prim and proper pianist who's like the golden child of this family. And then when the real world happens, it's like, no, I get everything. I'm the best. Why am I not the best? Why don't I have everything? And for the glass to break and that reality to just completely leave.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Like that's a really, I don't want to say fun, because in real life for people that's not fun, but for this character, that's a really fun exploration for me.
Yeah, there's a lot of real humanity in this book, surprisingly.
Yes.
It feels kind of cold and distant, kind of contrived a lot of ways, but like I said, the Donna stuff and the Gersten stuff, like that stuff punches through, like that stuff all resonates with me. Like it feels very real to me, just because I've known people like this that have these experiences or whatever, but you know, good stuff.
Yeah, Donna kind of has the opposite experience where she goes out and has a successful modeling career and, you know, dates all these high profile men and like gets all this money, but ultimately ends up having to come home and like reconnect with her dad. Well, you know, come home, you know, because I would say argue this is cheesy, but family is home.
Yeah.
He goes and reconnects with Doc and becomes his assistant. And now she's back in the family business. It's a completely opposite, but similar path. And it's a cool section. We spend too much time on it, but it is a cool section just to see. I think it could have been said in fewer words, but I liked seeing that juxtaposition between like Gersten's fall from being on top and then Donna getting on top and subsequently falling right back down. There's a fun labeling kind of trend with this book where a section is labeled by a person's name or a place, and then it has little to nothing to do with that person or place.
Right, exactly.
Yep.
Very common. Not the case with the next one, Ben and Audrey Horne, who I don't know that I learned that much about this section that we couldn't have already kind of grokked from the series and the first book, as far as what the relationship was here and how it ended up. I guess we get a little more of Audrey as she strikes out on her own post-coma. But anybody else glean anything from this that was...
Well, you know, the interesting thing with Secret History is that they do make a point, or Mark Frost makes a point to point out when the bank explosion happens that she was there for different reasons than we see in the show. And I mean, this continues that timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Just interesting.
She's there to make a deposit.
She was not, no.
Directly into the vault.
No, here she, I mean, in the Secret History, she was protesting rather than, well, I mean, she was protesting both times, but it was different causes.
Mm-hmm. The first one was the Ghostwood development, right? Or she was going in because she knew the bank was basically laundering money,
right?
Specifically to go toward the Ghostwood project, which she did not support.
Rewatch this show.
It's one of those B plots that's kind of hard to keep up with if you're not active about it.
Yeah, but it was almost as if, like, in the Secret History book, though, like, he hadn't changed his ways. And she was protesting the change of plan was.
But yeah, like the show, Ben kind of tries to, after the Palmer case,
he saves
Ben does try to reform after the Palmer case. And right. We kind of see that in the show.
Yeah.
In the, let's just say, the Mark Frost, like the Secret History final dossier and the return, the Frostverse kind of timeline, it's more like he was pursuing the Ghostwood project throughout the entirety of the original show. Audrey is protesting it, and she nearly dies in the explosion, and it feels like Ben's quest at reforming happened off screen, like his actual attempt to become a better person or whatever that we kind of saw the Civil War crap in the show. That realizing he did bad and trying to be a better person happened in that 25-year gap. So he's definitely reformed in the return, and then they touch on this. The best part of it, the cool thing about this section is it is a lot about the Ghostwood Project, and it is about how this kind of ties back into the Native stuff from the Secret History. Just how they built a prison in this kind of like sacred woods, and you know, it's called Ghostwood, and they talk about, I guess, Warden Murphy from The Return was supposed to be at the says, well, I wonder if his murder was related to his years at Ghostwood, implying that there's some sort of curse, you know, the haunted woods, and we put this evil like institutional prison there, and like that this is just an evil thing that we made in a place that's kind of haunted or cursed or whatever. And it's just like, it's not good.
It's a completely different Ghostwood project. Like the original idea was to preserve land and to, you know, keep this specifically the pine weasel, to keep these indigenous creatures in a habitable area that couldn't be developed on. Whereas in this book, it seems like the plan was always to sell the family ownage, like their acreage of the Ghostwood Forest, to be developed.
Right.
It's a completely different line of thinking.
Yeah.
So this is a different Ben Horne.
Yeah.
Who also goes into reform at a different time for different reasons.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
It also makes Audrey's line in season 3 make more sense to me, with it feels like Ghostwood in here. It feels like a prison. She feels like she's in prison. And it doesn't make sense.
Which means we would be seeing that interaction in the post-Saving Laura universe, which is, again, we're out of time. We're not on a linear structure of any kind here.
Right. It feels like Ghostwood in here. Yeah. I don't know what's going on.
It's weird though. The prison, like, it seems like it comes like way the hell out of left field, but it came way the hell out of left field in the access guide back in the day.
I was just going to say it's teased in there.
Yeah. It's one of the last pages and we're like, what the hell is this in there for? It's well, we finally got our answer to that too.
That's interesting. I don't think I knew that because I haven't sat with the access guide. So that's interesting.
Oh, that's completely unaware of that.
Yeah.
I actually have on my notes, the Ghostwood prison may be cursed. And it's mentioned in this book that there's an unreasonably high number of violent crimes and tragedies in the prison itself. That's like, she even mentions like it's not strange for prisons to have these things happen, but at this level is wild. Yeah. So yeah, I'd say the place is cursed, personally. The woods are cursed, the place is cursed.
This is cursed. That is cursed.
Yeah, I like the mention of Warden Murphy being the original warden there, who later transfers out to where he has the whole Mr. Strawberry encounters.
Yeah.
Sad, kind of sad stuff for Ben, who does really try to become a better person, but can't bring himself to sleep in his own home, you know, sleeps in his office, kind of dedicates all his time to maybe proving to Audrey that he can do better and prove to himself, because she's at this point moved down to her own apartment. She's not accepting any family money. She's going to raise this devil child, Richard, on her own, which I'm sure comes with its own unique challenges.
Yeah.
So, and maybe in this timeline, he's not so bad, but he's still ostensibly the product of Mr. C. So I have a feeling he's still going to be a problem.
It's interesting too, because they make a note that Ben has never met him.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was like, I always think of that line where he's just like, that kid's never been right, or however he words it in the
maybe
series.
Maybe just heard stories.
Right. Yeah. Because that's what I had to think of. I was like, seems odd. I mean, I guess not that odd.
I wouldn't claim to have met him.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't outright say that Audrey ends up in a psychiatric facility, but it's slightly implied that she ended up in private care.
Mm-hmm.
It also kind of posits that it was the fact that land was sold from the family, that her parents were divorced, that she found out she was pregnant shortly after coming out of a coma, that these things
after.
Yeah. Even though she seems to have
Billy Zane's
right.
Yeah, she seems to have been a pretty sound mind. Like, she went and got her GED. She studied business administration. She opened her own business. She opened a salon, ran it well, and then out of nowhere closes shop and disappears without much explanation here. But it tries to credit that, I think, to those events, which that seems like a long fuse for her to just close up and, you know, go into hiding / mental facility.
So before reading this book, because my mind was spinning with Audrey theories, especially because of what little were shown of Audrey, I couldn't help but wonder, especially with my mind thinking if she was a tulpa, that Mr. C had something to do with that, and maybe he got a hold of her and she was going to be a plan at some point the way the others were plans. But then this book, I'm just like, unless it's just when the stuff suddenly happened to her, maybe. But I mean, he did go visit her. Like, I don't know why it couldn't have just happened then. Mm-hmm. That's where I have such a problem with this Audrey chapter, because it just says a bunch of things that I don't care about with the way I was enjoying theorizing about what happened to Audrey.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this, we're getting a glimpse of like probably what was in the original plan to have her be doing in the show.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, because basically Sherilyn Fenn was like, this is bullshit. I'm not doing this role. Like, there's nothing she was not happy with the role. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, and it probably had something to do with basically this, like not a whole lot for her to do creatively, like, hey, okay, well, yeah, she hates her dad and moved away, and I guess she's living by herself, and I guess she has a hair salon and she's got this bastard kid, but it's like, and for what it's worth, that's an interesting thing about the making of The Return. Like, straight up, she's like, no, I am not doing this. And they were like, basically Showtime, she was probably one of the people that like had to be involved. Like, you have to bring her back, right? Like, she's got to be in this. And if she's saying she's not going to do it, because Lynch told her, like, God damn it, Sherilyn, now I've got to rewrite this thing. And he did. And so that's why it's this abstract, like, Eye of the Duck. Like, it's kind of like its own little, Audrey's thing in The Return, it like lives in its own little world. And you could make, there's a million different ways to interpret the Audrey thing, but one of them is just that this is kind of a microcosm of a bigger, like, she's trapped. She's trapped in whatever it is, nostalgia. She's trapped in, you know, not being able to navigate the world the way she wants it to. Anyway, Audrey's its own thing. But I basically think that this little few paragraphs is kind of what she was supposed to be doing in the show before she refused to do it.
So in another world, she said yes to this role. And this is what we read here.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I like that a lot, actually.
Like, I want to know what the original script was for her to be like, this is dog shit, and for Lynch to come back with, all right, we've got...
It was the Sylvia Horn scene.
You're going to get...
That's what I heard, yeah.
5 minutes of screen time. Sold.
It's that Sylvia Horn scene where she's getting beat on by Richard.
Richard, yeah, with Johnny. Hello, Johnny, how are you today?
And it would have been...
It would have been Audrey.
Okay. So she didn't want it to be her. It's not that somebody was getting assaulted. It's that it was...
Well,
her.
That might be part of it, too. Yeah. I don't know.
So I interviewed her, and she told me... I don't think that... She just thought that Audrey wouldn't have raised a kid that way, and that she wouldn't... Audrey doesn't take crap from people. Like, she would have fought back. Like, if that's the case... She didn't specifically tell... I brought that up to her. I was like, well, was it because of the, you know, the Richard Horn assaulting the grandma, and I guess that was supposed to be you or something. And she's like, well, I know that she said this. It was either before or since then, like at a convention, or she told people that, yeah, she didn't like that scene or something.
Ooh, did you plant that idea in her head?
Well, no, I just... She goes, I don't remember him specifically, like, what it specifically happened, but I know that Audrey Horn wouldn't take shit from her own kid. Mm-hmm. Like, she would fight back, or like, you know, that was just like in brief, just when we were talking.
Tyler said that on our show. Tyler said Audrey Horn wouldn't raise a child. She's got too much class. Because Dave's like, to raise a child?
But then I also said that a kid from her and Billy Zane would be like that.
You did.
Yeah, you did.
Feel terror on wheels. Yeah.
Wheeler. Wheels. Got it. Yeah.
But she's, I mean, you know, I don't know if Lynch or anybody else has said it, but she told me that she hated the part. There was nothing creative for her to do. And she broke down crying and said, I don't want to do this. And then Lynch came back, whatever, a few days later, and it was like, well, now I have to rewrite this. Well, here you go. Yeah, and you're right, Tyler. He's like, okay, so it's going to be super weird, and no one's going to know what's going on, and you're just going to stand there looking confused for like 45 minutes. And she went, great. Hey, to her credit, like...
Oh, she crushed it.
Yeah, it's great stuff, and it's challenging, and it's weird, and it's... It sucks that Audrey is such a favorite of everybody, and she got kind of pushed
except
back
Dave.
To the last. Yeah, but you know, she's the iconic.
Yes.
You know, yeah. She's definitely one of the most popular, and people were upset that it's like, well, she was just kind of like shoehorned into this little weird arguing with a dude that no one knows what's going on. Like, people were disappointed with how she ended up, but I think
disappointed.
In the long run, I think that was the smarter. I think that's cooler. Like, I think that she got to show some, even though those scenes are simpler and there's nothing going on, she got to show range. She got to be angry, and it is confusing and weird, and it is challenging for the viewer. Like, I just think those scenes are more interesting than her having a hair salon. I think her throwing a fit and demanding a new part benefited the show in the long run.
Yeah.
If we hadn't gotten that last scene of her waking up in the roadhouse and all that stuff, like, because there's probably another timeline that exists where we just get those like three scenes with Charlie, and then we're just like, what? Did they go to the roadhouse? Yeah, like, yeah. You know, like you can just see where they would just be left with that.
Is she getting Philip Jeffries through time back and forth and like popping in and out of these different settings, not really knowing where she is at any time?
So no, like she was definitely, it was definitely, that storyline was so disappointing. The end made it that much sweeter because it's just, yeah, now I can think of all these great theories. However, this book, like I said before, like kind of threw a wrench in some of my thoughts and ideas, but you know, unofficial versions.
Yes.
Well, I want to talk about my dream audio setup with Jerry Horn.
Please.
Isn't that amazing?
This is incredible.
It is very good.
So there's some stuff before we get to that, but apparently he collaborated with Neil Young, who has a heart of gold. Go ahead and say it. Get that out of the way.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
Like, worked along with him to convert multiple buildings into a massive speaker system that could induce avalanches.
Perfect.
Like, converted cabins into speakers and a shed into a subwoofer. And my mans will go out on the lake, remotely activate this thing, and play Miles Davis as loud as possible and just shake the lake while he just vibes.
Yeah.
Lake shakers.
While he's as high as a satellite, just floating out on the water.
Another prequel series I need.
No kidding.
Jerry is one of the lucky ones, if anybody is.
Well, that's proven too. I mean, I thought that in the return, he was going to just get into some deep shit. But he got himself out of the woods.
A lot of cardio.
Yeah, lost his clothes, but he made it out.
A lot of cardio.
Got a lot of cardio.
I love the visual of this just THC kingpin whose life goal is to just be high as a kite out on a raft with what I have to assume is a 6-foot Philly sub, just listening to music as loud as humanly possible in the middle of nowhere with no one around.
The dream, man.
It's the dream. I loved reading this section. So
it was a dream.
So inspiring. Exactly. Yeah, it probably was a dream. Anything on Jerry Horn? I'm taking all comers.
Oh, I just like how they snuck in that thing about the avalanches and everything. Yeah, but like Frost, he like sneaks in these little things. Yeah, there's like this whole misdirection thing. Like that, I mean, he actually says misdirection as a concept. And like, why not sneak in something about sound frequency, like right in the middle of Jerry Horn, where you're not going to be, you know, you'll absorb it, but you won't really put it all together. It's a good place for it.
Yeah, it's if you're going to hide something in a text like this, the Jerry Horn bed is the place to sneak it in.
Yeah.
That was fantastic.
Yeah, if we're talking about frequencies and its effect on the world, that's very clever.
Jerry seems to be the love letter, Frost love letter to maybe kind of nostalgic in a way, a time gone by kind of thing. This reminds me of the Grateful Dead, built those giant, you know, walls of speakers, you know, and
like which had to be an inspiration for the cabin conversions. Yeah,
of course. So it just, and they mentioned Ken Casey, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Carl Jung is mentioned in here. You know, Neil Young, the fact that this genius kind of 60s relic dude never grew out of it, and now he's growing weed and still a genius millionaire guy, but he's growing weed and building sonic contraptions to like shake the earth with sound. Like it's very 60s, it's very appropriate, very rock and roll, very Jerry, like, you know, survivors of the 60s that are still around probably are growing weed or you know, or still experimenting with sound. Like I know an audiophile dude like that's this about this age, and he's a total audiophile, and he does have a beard. He's not a stoner he's not a weed guy, but
disagree.
He builds it. Yeah, well, maybe he is, but he builds his own instruments. Like he's a total, like, and it just Jerry fits him to a T, you know. And so I think this is Frost and maybe Lynch too, being of the, this is the rock and roll generation right here. Like something that's dying off in the world, even as a guy like me that likes rock and roll, it's like every day it feels like that stuff is just like no one remember. I mean, I don't know. Jerry Horn liked the Doors, and I like the Doors, but everyone I know under 30 today is like, who? who are you talking about? I'm like, no, the Doors, just, man. The
just
Doors.
Show me the way to the next whiskey bar and go on.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. This is every bit the guy who stepped out of the back of a smoke billowing Airstream with girls on each arm 50 years down the road. This is where he ends up. It's great. It's the epitome of rock and roll.
Yeah.
And I like to think that this is the timeline where he didn't have to witness Richard get electrocuted to death while he sojourned in the woods.
Yes, exactly.
Witnessed, he did that with his binoculars.
You're right. He was the main contributor. Okay, I like the section called the double R because it's really not about the double R at all.
Mm-hmm.
In a way it is, because we do get some more empty wins here. But we basically get
the plot line we all wanted more info on. Oh, beef or pork?
Just this is pork.
Okay, so not so bad.
Said it was Norma's idea to add tablecloths and zhuzh it up.
Oh,
we
yeah.
All know it was Hanks.
We and all know it was Hanks. Bucks. Well, this is a different timeline, guys.
Yep, that's true.
To accept that some things are going to be different.
There's already a lot of reversals anyway, like Shelly Bobby before Laura Bobby, like, yeah, stuff like that. Like right, everything's right. Just a little bit backwards. And yeah, Norma being, you know, I mean, she's the paragon of the whole damn town practically. Mm-hmm. And you know, her getting the reversal of, you know, Hank. Yeah. I think it's fitting.
I like that it starts off with an inconsistency. So as Tammy is reporting on this, she's like, yeah, Marty Lindstrom did not die in 1978. She lost him then, sure, but he did not die there. And she opens it up like he mysteriously vanished and there was never a trace of him again. It's like, it said this happened, or Cooper said this happened, but there's no empirical evidence. Like, he, in fact, died around the time that her mother did. And then we get the deepest backstory possible on Vivian Smith.
Right. It just goes on.
Which is not about the double R.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I just don't know why we had to go into so much insight and speculation on Vivian Smith, Blackburn, right. Niles, right. Hallowell.
Yeah, and
to lull us into a feeling.
Yeah, right. To learn about the professor, more about the professor, Ernie Niles. Like, of all the season 2 B, C characters to show up for, you know, 3 episodes, I was not expecting to learn more about Ernie here.
We just needed to get the backbone of, like, Annie's life. Before she came to town. So, I mean, I think you kind of have
to... Just had to get there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wasn't there a discrepancy here?
Oh, dude. I stopped trying to figure out.
All over the place on this one.
Yeah, because...
This is a discrepancy of, like...
The secret history, so again...
Five or six years.
Yeah, this is where... the Secret History tried to rewrite the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, okay, well, he made a mistake in the Secret History. And then you watch The Return and you realize there's timelines and other things going on. And you're like, oh, okay, this is all about, like, maybe it's a different timeline. And then you come back to the final dossier, and this is not the only place, but there are several times where it's like, well, could be another timeline, or this could solely just be people's perception or how memory works. So this is all set up to either be alternate dimensions and alternate timelines and quantum physics and all that kind of stuff, or it's just like, hey, man, life's not perfect. Documents aren't perfect. People's perceptions are weird. People's memories are flawed. Even documents are not perfect. And this is what life is. It's just this kind of soup of imperfections. And, you know, but this one, it's like, at this point, like, does it even matter? This is the point where I threw up my hands. I'm like, I don't give a shit about Vivian or Ernie. I hate Ernie. I hated him in the show. I couldn't give a crap, but I get it now. I get it. Like, now it's whatever you want it to be. Is this an alternate universe? Mm-hmm. Sure. Is it because she even said, Tammy's like, I think Agent Cooper made a mistake when he was talking. It's like, no, man, like, okay.
Tammy, dumb ass.
Yeah, maybe.
You made a mistake.
Yeah, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, whatever. Like, at this point, with John, like, you kind of have to go through with this because you're about to get to what everyone's been waiting for how's Annie finally answered in the final dossier, right?
Yeah, I got beef on that.
Yeah. But I just want to throw one thing in. The final page 53, the final thing about Tammy is Tammy takes a good dig at Vivian.
Oh, yeah.
It's like I basically, she finds a nice way of saying, I hate this woman because she was a terrible mom and screwed up her daughter's lives. And so I think that's great. But also, when I read this, this is when kind of a light went off in my brain and I realized the theme of the mother. The mother is like how Fire Walk With Me and maybe the old show is kind of like the sins of the father, and like Bob and Leland are like front and center. Mm-hmm. With The Return, I mean, she's not front and center because The Return is so epic, but there's definitely, whatever you want to call it, like Judy is living inside Sarah Palmer, or there's evil inside the Palmer house, or this woman is dealing with her guilt and, you know, for being a kind of a passive bystander for the abuse of her daughter, like to what degree did she know or whatever. But basically, moms in the new Twin Peaks, in the books, in the show, they don't get an easy pass. That, you know, Frost digs at Vivian. The Return is all about, not all about, but a lot to do with Sarah Palmer, right? This is Sarah Palmer's like dealing with her trauma and whatever. Well, in a way,
Audrey.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Basically, all the moms get taken to task in the Return. Oh, and
Shelley.
Shelley, the final dossier, the Hayward mom. You know, Donna kind of shuns the Hayward mom for keeping this a secret, and then she dies kind of tragically, and Donna doesn't even go to her funeral. Mm-hmm. So when Tammy's like, I'm really angry at this mom because she was such a shitty mom, that's when I was just like, oh man, like The Secret History, Final Dossier, and to a large degree The Return, like really kind of the mom, the sins of the mother, I guess, is the lack of the best way I could explain it. The way Fire Walk With Me dealt with the father abuse or whatever, like, I just thought there was an interesting dichotomy of when the Twin Peaks comes back, it's kind of all about the mom, you know, in a weird way.
I really liked that they took the time to plug in the fact that Vivian had started a restaurant that failed before coming to review the Double R as Empty Wince. That was just a fun little nugget for me.
It's like, of course.
Yeah, I loved it. What a good dig. Like, the fact that she... So there's a lot of stuff in here that is like, why is Tammy putting this in this book? And B, why does the FBI need to have this on file? But that for me, that's one of those very personal things. Is like, I'm just going to offhandedly mention that she started a restaurant which failed, then went to accuse her daughter of having a terrible restaurant. And the way that's worded too is pretty elegant and scathing.
Yeah,
actually in the text.
And stepdaughter too, right? Or am I misremembering that?
Stepdaughter. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Ilsa is her birth mother.
Right.
Who died in 1985, around the same time as her father. But they had been separated, and Annie was the child of Vivian and her father, Marty, who ended up getting the surname Blackburn through adoption. And whereas I guess we're getting into that in the next part, Annie Blackburn, which opens, I don't know if it opens up with, but really goes in on Cooper as a person. Like, she holds him to blame, and she asks if she's being too hard on him, but basically goes into Cooper's past and says, well, if he hadn't cavorted with Wyndham Earl's wife, which you reported on the fact that he orchestrated that himself, like, sorry, but you're wrong here. Like, to go in on him saying that it was his fault for being involved with his wife, which led him to be his enemy, which led him to target Annie as the winner of Twin Peaks and of Miss Twin Peaks. And that, no, this is not Cooper's fault. This is Wyndham Earl's fault. Like, I have beef and I'm mad. The beef is cooked. I'm hot enough to cook the beef. It's ready to add noodles and milk and make it hamburger helper.
Maybe the angle is that if Cooper didn't have the White Knight syndrome thing where, like, he needed to save people, he wouldn't have been so easily orchestrated into the situation that he got in.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that would be fair. But I also feel like as a trained FBI agent, he would have the wherewithal to go to Annie and say, hey, something's going to happen tonight if you win this thing. I can't tell you exactly what, but if you win, you're in trouble. If you're announced, immediately hide.
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't
lift
giant,
a finger though. To help.
Yeah, he wasn't. I mean, the giant told him no, and he still didn't listen.
Yep.
Yeah.
The giant who has famously given great information and never left anything out.
That was great information.
Yeah, that was the most blatant explanation he ever gave. Yeah.
I will tell you three things. No, wait, like six things, but it's going to take a minute.
And then 30 more things over the next 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, you know, this is like something a toddler could know. The
yeah, but
arm
it,
wave.
I could look at him and go, nah, you got me before.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying, but I don't know.
Frost also said in an interview that I read, someone was talking about the White Knight stuff and a bunch of other stuff too. And he was just like, hey, just remember, like, this is Tammy's perception of events. But then other interviews, he talks in depth about Cooper being kind of a flawed character and things like that. I don't know where I draw the line as to, like, does he really have White Knight syndrome, or is that his job?
Right.
Like, it's your job to save and protect people. And, like, I think that if it was Ben Horn that got taken to the Black Lodge by Wyndham Earl, Cooper still would have gone after him, I think.
The motivations probably might have been slightly different, but he would have.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. The motivations
would have been. But he would have done the job. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, or even if it's not his job, like, he's like David Lynch. Like, he's a Boy Scout. Like, again, even if he wasn't an FBI agent, no matter who got taken to the Black Lodge, he probably would have gone in after him.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think the White Knight stuff in here is cool, and it's given birth to all kinds of kind of alternate views. And it gives the audience permission, and it was maybe me for the first time, to just kind of think as Cooper's like, oh, okay, like, yeah, you're right. Like, he's not a perfect guy. Like, no one's perfect.
He's a human being.
Yeah. And, like, and this is, you know, the original show, like, he is kind of like the idyllic character, you know, and he doesn't do anything wrong. And I think maybe I lived with that for 20 years. Like, well, he was great. He was perfect. Yeah. He was Cooper. Mm-hmm. He was awesome. And then mm-hmm. then the return, and then this book kind of gave me permission to kind of open up and think critically of him a little bit. Yeah. Now, all that being said, I personally don't think White Knight Syndrome is the right framing of it, at least in my mind. I think it's cool that people are running with that idea, but it implies that it's all these women in trouble. Oh, he's trying to save Laura Palmer. He's trying to save Laura Palmer. It's like, is he? Is he trying to save Laura Palmer, or is it just kind of like in his programming to do, or is this, I still contend, even Ben Horn, the biggest prick in Twin Peaks, if he'd have been taken to the Black Lodge, no, Ernie Niles. Even if Ernie got dragged by Wyndham Earl to the Black Lodge, I think Cooper would have gone in after him.
Yeah.
Would he have run after him as quickly?
No, and he would have been so sweaty.
Yeah.
He would have slipped right through those curtains.
I love the visual of Wyndham Earl going to snatch Ernie Niles and just slipping like he's oiled up.
12 rainbow trout.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah, that is 12 rainbow trout, isn't it?
Oh,
man.
Oh, yeah.
Adjust these, Ty.
Listen, Mr. Earl, I'm just not cut out for this. You can't take me in there. You can't take me into the Black Lodge. You just can't take me in there because I'm just not cut out for this. I just can't do this. I don't know what to do. Shut up.
I'm crying.
And his wire is what
tie tarantulas to your teeth.
Wyndham's head go on fire.
Yeah, exactly.
What if the perfect foil to save the day was if he had tried to take Ernie in and just couldn't bring himself to do it because it was too much?
Oh man.
I can see that playing out right outside the Glastonbury Grove. Oh man.
So yeah, the Annie Blackburn chapter does not talk about Annie.
Right.
No.
What about Annie or Ernie?
Annie or Ernie, yeah. We wrote our own way better chapter just here, just now.
How's Ernie?
Don't do that to me.
How's Ernie?
Sorry.
How's Ernie?
I didn't think there would be another way to get a good joke in out of that. Oh, man.
Yep.
Well, since we're talking about Wyndham Earl, let's talk about Wyndham Earl. Chess grandmaster at 14 years old. Nerd.
He's no Pete Martell, though.
He's no Pete Martell. He's no match for him. apparently inspired by a film to join the FBI and met Caroline during Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
All information that is superfluous. And again, why do we need to know this? An FBI official dossier,
right,
being reported to the head. I don't know.
Yeah, the framing devices, they've always been kind of questionable. I don't know. I'm still mad at Tamara for not, like, scanning through the entire dossier and getting to page, like, 330, whatever it was, where the archivist actually says, I'm Garland Briggs.
Yeah.
Yeah, mystery solved.
Yeah, so
her methods said that in the episode.
Yeah, her methods are just, you know, whatever they are. Oh.
It seems kind of stream of consciousness, which is... that tracks for Twin Peaks. That's fine.
Yeah.
But what I like about this chapter is that it, for me, really brings home the fact that Wyndham Earl is an absolute psychopath. And not only did he kill his own wife, he also killed everyone that Cooper and Caroline were investigating together. When he saw the spark between them, he orchestrated killings to get them to come together to, I don't know, cuck himself and give himself a reason to make attacks on both of them.
Mm-hmm. I've been cooked.
And it was it was his doing. And that, again, Tammy, you wrote this report. You have this information. Tammy takes this opportunity again to go in on Cooper about White Knight Syndrome. Like,
she's super jealous.
That's exactly it, Tyler. That is exactly it. I don't remember who said that, but like, again, keep in mind with Frost again saying, hey, this is her perspective. Think about it. Think about it. Like, she's the new like hot, not like physically hot, but like she's the hot young new agent that's trying to impress the boss.
Would you do her?
I'm saying like she's the young up and coming agent trying to impress the boss. Yeah. And you know what? To be fair, there's this town called Twin Peaks and a trail of dead bodies and the strangest crap she's ever seen. And it's just kind of natural to like, hey, maybe your star pupil wasn't so great, boss. You know?
Like, let's look at the lowest common denominator here.
Yeah. Hey, maybe Agent Cooper isn't as cool, isn't as great as you think.
Yeah.
Like, maybe I'm super cool and Agent Cooper's not as cool. You know, but I definitely think that Frost is playing with that too.
I would not be surprised.
Yeah, very common tactic to defame the golden child to make yourself look better. This is what we call in the business bullying. Some of it has credence, like to say that there's, like, obviously we watch this agent who seems to be coming to the aid of young women in need. It can be perceived as such. But again, like we speculated, if it had been other people put in dire situations, and it has been, like he's shown up for Harry when he was just destitute about losing Josie. And when when he stacked furniture in his office and had a gun and was drinking heavily, Cooper showed up for that. And like, he's this kind of guy. He goes where help is needed. And maybe that, by definition, is White Knight Syndrome, but it's not the like I help people to a fault. It's in my perspective, it's I help people because that is my job and that's where I'm supposed to be to do it. I have the skill set to help. I should be the one to show up there, and anyone who can help me is welcome to come along. He doesn't deny help.
And I think that's the only thing that Frost goes in on. Is like he always says that, you know, Cooper got caught by his hubris. You know, it's not White Knight exactly, but hubris absolutely fits what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of the thing. Basically, Frost calls it hubris, but Tammy in the book, Frost as Tammy in the book, she frames it as White Knight. The hubris, too, like, extends into the return, like the audacity to think that you can go back in time and change things.
That is Olympic level hubris.
I mean, that's White Knight or not. I mean, White Knight Syndrome to me is like, I'm always the guy that helps people move because I don't have any friends or I want people to like me. So I'm going to volunteer to help people all the time. Even if that takes up all my time and money. I want to help people because it makes me feel better, you know, or maybe I'll get a friend out of this or maybe I'll whatever. So it's like, I'm the guy with the pickup truck that always helps people move, you know, it's like, but I don't have a life because I'm always trying to help other people. And ultimately it's like a selfish goal. To me, that's what like White Knight Syndrome is.
But, right.
But yeah, whatever. All right.
And wouldn't it be funny if she's talking White Knight because she's actually giving this report to Gordon? And like he's got this history of just like, you know, the nieces and all, like all these other digs that have been happening. You know, it's like it's her subtle way of saying, you know, it's like it's not cool.
Yeah. Totally. I agree. I see that. I can totally see that. Oh, and for the record, I am not going to help any of you guys move.
I'm not going to help myself move. I'll hire movers. It's worth every penny.
I did get mixed signals from that, so.
Tune in next time to hear part two of our discussion on the final dossier.
You can email us at talkingbackwardspod@gmail.com. Patrick?
You can hit us up on Twitter @talkingbackward.
Tyler?
Anchor.
.fm/talkingbackwards. That's where you can find all the good stuff. We're also on Patreon at patreon.com/talkingbackwards. There's so much to find there. Go look at it. Subscribe. Get good things. Yes, thank you for listening as always. This has been Talking Backwards, and we'll see you
in the trees.